Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about how we've polished and playtested an adventure that we designed live on this channel, The Creeping Doom of the Pumpkin King, and what happens when we co-DM a creepy wilderness adventure with lots of roleplay and improv. All that and more today on Wandering DMs!
Before we get into it, as always, I'll remind everyone that at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That's a live video chat that happens on our private Discord server, which you can join in by joining our Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our Discord server. Join that, and around a little after 2 p.m. Eastern Time, well, maybe 2:10 Eastern Time, we'll be there hosting a live video chat with Dan and I and all of our patrons. So hope to see you there.
We love that. We will enjoy seeing you show up here this weekend. So, Paul, first of all, it's a pleasure to be with you live.
Yeah, this is becoming a habit.
It is, right? So, once again, I have driven up from Brooklyn, New York, and I'm visiting Wandering DM headquarters here in the greater Boston area, Massachusetts. And we did that specifically in order to have an opportunity to run one of the adventures that we created on the channel here, which has the index of WDM04, A Creeping Doom of the Pumpkin King, which is part of our Dungeon Design Dash series. You can see prior episodes here, and there's a link to this particular adventure in the YouTube description right now. So,
yeah, just real quick for folks who maybe don't know or haven't seen those episodes or new to the channel, we have in the past a couple times done what we call a Dungeon Design Dash, where in 1 hour we take a pre-existing map, usually taken from Dyson Logos, that's one of our favorite map makers, put that up there and stock it for a full adventure in about an hour. And then when it's done, we publish that to a code, just a very short 2-ish page PDF that we distribute for free to all our patrons as a patron benefit, and also put it up for sale on DriveThruRPG for, I think, $1 a piece. So you can find the old ones there if you missed out. This one has not yet been published, so, you know, good news is one of the interesting things about having done this, playtested this game, is it's kind of pushed us to the point where I think we can publish this thing finally.
Right, yeah. So let's talk about that. And big thanks to our viewers showing up in the chat. And Bacrius, thanks for checking that we are live to our channels. It's a big help, as always. So it's been slightly embarrassing. All right. So I'm just going to come out and say that the original design of this adventure was about 2 years ago. Right.
Cool. And, that long ago.
Yeah,
holy cow.
Right.
Really? 2 years?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes, sir. And it's been sitting on our back burner, and Paul, you and I both have lots of other projects.
Yeah,
and it's been sitting on the back burner for us. But I think that having had the opportunity to sit down together this weekend, talk about how we wanted to polish it and finish it, mm-hmm. and then getting an opportunity to play test it, I think has crystallized why it was somewhat more challenging to finish up. And among the things that's occurred to me is that it is our first wilderness adventure.
Yep.
And I think that part of it is that it's necessarily at a larger scope and a broader abstraction level. Mm-hmm. And therefore, there's necessarily just a lot more stuff. It being in the wilderness, there's more different directions the players could go that you're trying to maybe anticipate. There's more opportunities for, like, instead of just, like, a room as being an encounter, now it might be a whole village or a whole castle. Mm-hmm. And so there might be a question about how much detail, as the writers, how much detail do we give to those places? Or how much detail does the DM have to make up on the fly?
Yeah, it's really fascinating, I think. I've been thinking a lot about, like, what our process is going to be going forward if we do more dungeon design dashes, which I'd really love to do. And you know, it makes for a great episode first when we just sit there and stock the dungeon, a lot of creativity going back and forth. There's definitely subsequent steps that I think are important. And it's in my head to, and maybe I'll throw this out to the viewers, of like, what of this content would you actually like to see versus what should we do privately? I think one of those is just you and I going back and re-looking at it and editing it and talking about how would we run it, et cetera. And then one is actually running it, right? Yeah. I think actually running these things is super helpful, so we could live stream that as well if that's of interest. Yeah. So viewers, let us know if either of those, if like watching us live edit or watching us live play test one of these games is interesting, let us know. Maybe we'll look at doing that for a future.
A good point. Yeah. To be clear, part of what happens is so far is that when we do it for the hour live, we do kind of the interesting meat, plotty, what's here, who's here stuff. And then among the passes that we do on our plates, like you do a lot of the polish for the formatting publication of it to make it look nice. And I do stuff like I come through and at least do a first pass of inputting statistics and appropriate treasure amounts. Is something that I come through and do, partly using our OED, monster metric system to kind of have the right number of monsters running around trying, sort of. That's never an exact science.
Yeah.
But my assumption is that that's not the most interesting part of the sign, right? The number crunching part. So that part we've been doing offline.
Yeah, that. And you know, the visual editing of just like, you know, when we make these, it's very rough and it's in a couple, it looks all like almost publishable, but like you want it to fill the page and maybe throw some stock art in there or something to fill it out, make it a little more visually interesting. Yeah, that's probably not really exciting to stream.
That's my assumption. Right.
But I think possibly that what we did prior to running this game, where we just sat down and looked at it and read through it and talked about each encounter, and like you know, rather than just the initial like creative blast, sat and talked about like how would we run this. Right. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe that would be an interesting topic. I don't know. Maybe not.
I feel like this one was different. I feel like this one was different, had a lot more for us to discuss. And there were ongoing questions. Here we are 2 years later. Yeah. But there were ongoing questions up until Friday, Saturday, when we're running here this weekend, about who is this? What's the motivation for this? And who are these people going to do? And what happens in this case? So I think that this particular adventure was kind of a learning experience about the unique demands of a larger scale, larger scale that happens in this wilderness type situation at a more abstract layer there. Personally, I think I want the next one to be another dungeon adventure just to compare and contrast.
It's been a while since we've done a dungeon, so we could do that.
I would like to do that.
It's been a while since we did any of it.
It's true. We are talking about the last dungeon design dash that we did, and we both of us want to do more, but we were kind of committed to finishing one, the last one, before we go and do another one.
Yeah. Now, I'll point out, like, when we were titling this episode, right, like, we specifically talked about calling out social encounters, because I think that's the other interesting thing about this particular adventure, is that there's actually a fairly large opportunity for social encounters. Which you posited is maybe due to it being a wilderness adventure.
I think so. It felt like that. So you were talking when we were driving over the other day about how injecting social interactions into a dungeon feels forced.
Yeah.
And people do that. And my understanding is in the Greyhawk Castle, there were, you know, shops in the dungeon, and there was like a tax collector at the entrance of the dungeon that would like take a magic item every time it came out or something like that. But I, you know, depending on how fantastical you want to go, you can make that happen. But I agree that it feels forced.
It feels a little odd, right? Yeah, and I can think of specific examples. You have things like in the first level of Stonehell, there's a quadrant that's specifically a whole like goblin run marketplace where different monsters have an uneasy peace, right, that they agree not to fight each other there. So there's a whole marketplace there that you can go to and be more sociable. I think of like Pool of Radiance, right? In Pool of Radiance, in the slums, there's a section where you go and eventually you find a wizard who, like, give you a job, and it's to go to another room and go talk to another guy, like a broker an exchange.
Yeah.
Right? And so these are people who are, like, I don't know, maybe they're not good, but they're willing to, have a back and forth, a conversation with the characters rather than just attack on sight.
Right.
you know, and yeah, those feel weird to me. Like, why is this wizard living here in this, like, really kind of crappy location?
Right.
Why would you live
and
underground?
And why is this safe? Like, why have they not been eliminated in a conflict before now when they live 40 feet away or something like that?
Now, I guess I could contrast that with the case I can think of where it was done well, which is actually in Dyson's Delve, where we have the were-rat lair.
Yes.
Right, where that is fun, and they're, like, clearly they're living down there, but they, you know, it makes sense for were-rats to live underground, right?
Yeah.
Part of this.
Yeah.
So maybe that's just what
that's
I'm
a good point.
Pushing against.
That's
like,
a good
why
point.
Do you have a human wizard living in this terrible place?
And it's also not, you know, the were-rats are interesting because it's not set up intrinsically to be, like, a shop. Like, it's not set up of, like, you're going to go here and you must negotiate with them. When I was playing through it, I was personally surprised. I was really surprised when the other players opened up negotiations and it worked.
Yeah.
So it's a set piece that can go in a couple different directions and has an element of risk and danger to it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's what we did a good job with. It felt very natural to put in our Creeping Doom of the Pumpkin King adventure is... As it turns out, most of the encounters have that same kind of texture of they're kind of creepy. You can talk to them. You might be able to negotiate with them.
Yep.
They might attack you. They might have some precious object that you might want to come back and steal surreptitiously. So you go into it, which is great, and I love. And you go into it really not knowing which way the encounters are going to go. So as a DM, you have to have a lot more flexibility being okay with that.
Let's look at the actual adventure. I want to pull up the map, if that's all right. See if I can get that on screen for us real quick. Right. So here's the cover of the Dungeon Design Dash, which is available on our Drive-Thru RPG. And then if I just jump to the DM's map here. So this is, if you look at this map, right, it's an overland map where essentially, there's a line that cuts right through it from the bottom left to the top right, or vice versa, right? There's a trail that goes across the map in that direction. Now, I ran this once before.
Right. So this is, now you've run this two times.
This is now the second time I've run it, but the first time we ran it is co-DMing, and we should definitely talk about that, but put a pin on that real quick. My experience from running it the first time was I actually enjoyed having them start in the bottom left and working to the top right, rather than the other direction, even though the numbers would imply that the other way is the way it's done. And partly because I feel like there was more potential for buildup of social tension and those kind of social encounters. So if you look at this map, if you're coming up from the bottom left, area 6, there's a couple nomad camps. Area 5, there's a farm. And then eventually you get up to, I think, area 2, where there's a castle. And they're in, like, increasingly tied into the main villain of this whole central piece, which is the Creeping Doom, or the Creeping Jack, right? Which is a consciousness, a fungal growth consciousness that is basically rampant throughout the land and kind of presents as pumpkins. So you have nomads, one camp which is actually fine, but they're more recently arrived, and another camp that has been infested by the Creeping Jack. And you have the farmland, which is definitely infested by the Creeping Jack. And that does give you interesting social encounters where you have enemies who wish... ill, I guess, on the party, right?
Yeah.
Well, they want to, you know, infest them and
low,
bring them
low level, right? Yeah. Low key. They're not going to immediately attack you,
right?
Like standard D&D dungeons, but they're trying to get you on their side,
right? So interestingly, right, it sets you up for that social encounter where they're going to want to talk and going to want to lie and going to want to, like, convince the players to. Expose themselves in some way, right? Right. When we discussed this, we decided the nomads were less subtle about it. They would just try to, like, capture you, tie you to a post, and force feed you the horrible stuff that infests you. Whereas the farmers, they're less, you know, they're farmers, right? They're less aggressive, so they're gonna just try to, like, kill you with kindness, right?
It's great.
Come on in.
Well put.
You know,
well
come
put.
On in. We'll feed you. We'll give you a place to stay.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll poison you over in the middle of the night.
Right.
While you sleep, right? So, so this is just, I think, the adventure intrinsically has those built-in options for, like, social. And even the castle, right? You've got, it's a very creepy setup, but again, they try to incorporate you, and they try to say, like, oh, this is normal. Come on in, join our feast, participate in our games. you know, and then eventually let us convert one of you into our new king that lives here for the next year before we kill you and feed you to the next king.
I like that a lot. I mean, I think when we did it in practice, I think it came off successfully creepy, right? Successfully horror movie type vibes. Yeah. And the players, our players this weekend, I feel just skirted right up to the edge of disaster each time as they engaged it and you know, picked up on the clues and, you know, got out at exactly right before disaster struck.
Now we gave them the objective of simply cross, right? Get to the mountain pass and get through this area, right? So they were a bit inclined to avoid conflict because the goal was to get to the other side. And also just that they're cagey old school D&D players. So they knew that, like, don't get distracted by stuff that doesn't have obvious treasure or obviously help us in our goal.
Yes. They were very strategic.
Strategic. Yeah. So, like, they tried to avoid the nomads completely. They talked to the farmers, but then we're like, thanks, but no thanks.
And I like that, you know, we had, and we were just tuning it a couple days ago. So like, when you come through the first area that we're calling six here, we had two competing camps of nomads in Area 6 on two separate hills that you have to walk through. And so to distinguish them, we made one obviously very green and with vines all around and gardens, and the other one with a bunch of animal stockades, goats and pigs and sheep and stuff like that. And I was very pleased that one of the players saw that and immediately, oh, we got a whole Cain and Abel thing going on here.
Yeah, which was exactly your inspiration.
Exactly the motivation for that. Yeah. And of course, it's the ones that's all covered with vines that are actually infested. And it's the ones that wound up interacting with. So the players were like, we don't want any part of this. We want to go right through. We just want to go right through the dead center and not interact with them.
I was pleased how we adjudicated that too, right? Where we basically, the player's goal was like, we're just going to stay on the trail, just ignore both camps, and just go right through. And so we were like, well, what do the two groups do? And we decided ultimately just, let's just roll in the reaction chart and see.
Twice.
What they do.
Two reaction rolls, one for each camp, right?
Yep. And I think the animal guys were cagey.
Totally neutral.
Right. And then what was the result for the...
I think it was like the first positive one for the invested type. So like a small group of the infected nomads came down to chat with them, and the players were just like, we just keep hiking. Like, okay, we'll let them talk to us, but we just keep hiking out of the area. And the, you know, the infected nomads were like, well, we live on the blessed hill of bounty, and that other hill is the cursed flesh eaters, and how could you possibly, you've got to watch out for those guys.
Yeah.
And the players, and they were like, you know, anytime if you're low on food or water, please come back and stay with us, but avoid them.
Yeah.
And the players successfully like, okay, maybe, but we're just hiking right out of the scene. So, and I was ready, to, you know, have them attack if they had backup and they were closer, but the fact that they got away from it was the right thing to do.
And let's maybe pause for a second to talk about how we co-DM, because that's probably, people are probably starting to wonder that as we're talking about this. So at the high level, right, we ran it much like our show The Big Bad, where we split up the DMing responsibilities into referee, which was played by me, and adversary, which was played by Dan. So basically, I narrated a lot, right? I kind of took the traditional, what you consider the DM role when the players are just trekking around and exploring the world. And then when they encountered anything, Dan would roleplay the people they're encountering. Now I would jump in, certainly, and roleplay minor characters or other secondary characters or whatnot, or even toss in an NPC or take over a character if I felt like I wanted to add information or nudge things in a direction. But Dan was really out to play the NPCs to the hilt, right? To kill the party or whatever. Let's say push the objectives of the NPCs as hard as possible without regard to the player's good fortune.
So and that worked a little, and it was interesting because that had a different texture than we normally do. So when we run The Big Bad or before that our convention boss fights for breakfast games, as the adversary, basically every encounter is automatically a combat.
Yep.
Right? It's just like fights are happening, and when the encounter starts, it's by definition a fight starting, and you hand over control of the monsters to me, and I'm just trying to murder the player characters round by round all the time. And then we jumped into this one again with more social interactions at a higher level. And now I'm engaging in these NPC role-playing interactions. And that was actually most of what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
And so we had a little bit of a conversation beforehand where I asked, do I need to check in with you if and when I switch from negotiation to fighting? Like, can I, along the way of a conversation, can I just say, and now we attack the players, or do we need mutual buy-in for that? And you gave me total authority to run the NPCs as I saw fit.
Yeah, basically, right? And I basically kind of considered it the exact same way if you had, say, a group of players who don't trust each other and one decides to attack the other, right? I'm like, okay, it should be just like that. You can talk to them as much as you want to talk to them, and when somebody decides to pull out a sword, I'll just use the rules as written, right? If I feel like somebody has the drop on someone else, they get a surprise attack.
Yeah.
If not, let's roll some dice to find out initiative order.
And there were, and then as usual when that happened, and it's partly kayfabe, but I'm legislating. I'm trying to represent the NPCs as and the monsters as well as I can. Mm-hmm. So when those things happening, I'm arguing for, like, I should get a surprise attack, and you know, you may or may not say no, I think this is an initiative instead. Or if the players get a surprise attack, I will be arguing for no, this, we should roll initiative fairly. And so we generally have that same, I think, halfway entertaining back and forth, where I'm arguing in favor of the monsters, which may or may not be adjudicated by Paul as he sees fit.
You know, I was asked by someone, like, how it rolls out in practice when we split the DMing role like this, and I said it's actually really delightful for a couple of reasons. Like, on the one hand, as adversary, it frees you to just really play the adversaries to the hilt, right? To just focus on strategy. It gives you more time to think about the objectives of the NPCs or the tactics if you're in a combat, and just play them to the best of your ability, because you're constantly thinking about it and not juggling rulings and, pacing and all the other things that a DM has to do. On the other hand, I also think it really helps the players, because the players then realize that they can engage in the, like, adversarial relationship they have with you, right? Like, whether that's shit-talking or, you know, or just, like, outright attacking, etc., without any fear of repercussion that you're in charge of the game, because you're not.
Right?
Exactly. They can get a fair ruling from me,
right?
And then they can talk a lot of shit to you.
It's a really important aspect, actually. And the other thing that's neat is that we start off presenting what's going to happen to players that haven't seen this before, and you specifically say, I will be honest with you in rules. So if you have any rules questions, forward them to me, and you can ask rules questions to Dan if you want to, but he's going to lie. He's going to lie to you basically all the time, or whatever is in his best interest. So I would recommend that you not do that. And then occasionally players will ask me rules questions, particularly if you're busy, right? Will ask me rules questions, and I'll say blah, and they'll go, I think you're lying. Which I don't think you'd normally say to, like, your normal DM, right? But they're like, you're bullshitting me.
Is that, I wonder if that's okay. I wonder if that, I felt like in some cases that bit us a little bit, where I'm like, no, Dan actually knows the rules, and it's fine to ask him rules questions.
Yeah.
But, like, I did want to encourage them, like, when in doubt, like, confirm with me, right? Like, make sure you're asking me for the actual ruling, because I, you know,
it's
am the one who makes the call at the end.
Yeah, it's true. So this was a play through that was mostly social interactions, and we went at least the first half. So I think we were playing 6-ish hours.
About 6 hours.
Probably like an hour of setup, and then about 6 hours of play.
And that's interesting for people to know. Anybody who's picking up WDM04 and is wondering how long it's going to run. I mean, frankly, they still only saw maybe half the content on that map, and we were kind of like rushing at the end to wrap things up in 6 hours.
Yeah.
So I'd say you could easily get a good 3 to 4 normal sessions of play out of
It's true. Thing. It's absolutely true. Yeah. So at least it could have, it could have easily been 12 hours for us.
Yeah.
I would say. And it's an opportunity to flesh these things out, and it's interesting that we're doing So for me, we had a lunch break about halfway through. So it was about the 3 hour point or something like that, and we didn't have any fights.
We hadn't had
a single fight.
First couple hours, no fights.
And I hear about that. I don't think that I've ever had a D&D session with zero fights in my career. But 3 hours in, and I was like, well, this might be it. I guess this might possibly be how that happens.
Yeah.
As we've gone through, I think at that point, 3 encounters or something like that, and the players had managed to avoid any fights to that point, which was the right thing. But we were having a great time because... You know, so my role then for the kind of the first time in our co-DMing situation became role-playing, interacting, coming up with a voice, coming up with information, coming up with trying to trick the players into bad situations. And then as you're saying, which hadn't happened in the Fest, is that you were jumping in, and you and I have done this before with co-DM type situations, but you were jumping in, then we had... two NPCs that were chatting, possibly with basically the same personality and motivation, sometimes with differing points of view, possibly, that the players had to evaluate. We've done that before.
We had, I mean, for context, right, Dan and I have a lot of practice in this. First of all, we've just both played as players in games together plenty of times, right, over the long years that we've been playing D&D together. But then also, we once ran a campaign where we co-DM'd. It was like our first real experiment with co-DMing. And what I remember that is we hadn't really figured out the splitting of roles, the adversary and referee at that point. We were just both kind of winging it. And we found that over the course... And that was a long campaign. That was like many months of a campaign. And what we found is we were always introduced the NPCs in pairs. There's always two guards at the gate. There's always two farmers on the farm, right? There's always two of everything so that you and I could then roleplay characters. And sometimes to the detriment of like the pacing of the game, because then we would just dive in and it became the Dan and Paul show.
Right. we've gone over the edge on that in the past. I think that was in the front of our minds when we were doing that, is that we have to be aware of the room if this is entertaining or, you know, to get back on the pace where the players are doing stuff.
Now that said, when the players did get to the farm, and that's exactly what we did, is right, they're approaching the farm and they see two workers in the field, and so sure enough, we're role playing them, and I'm letting Dan kind of take the lead. I'm playing the secondary character, but we just got into like role playing, you know, bumpkins, right? We were playing two farmers who like never left the farm, and who had a vague like sense of like, well, we're infested by the creeping jack, and we want to entice these people back to our house, but other than that, that's basically it. We kind of and frankly, it was some of the most hilarious bits of roleplay in the game, right?
The players said afterwards that was a highlight. And they were recording a little bit at one point. And I like, so one character stayed back for safety, and then they went back and communicated what was happening, and they were saying, "Well, we're dealing with these hillbilly idiots." And I was like, that is, I think we nailed the characterization that we were going for there. So that seemed to carry over well. And you know what, for whatever reason, we did actually manage to convince the players to actually come into the house and actually meet the rest of the large extended family that we then had to detail. And like there's these two, and then there's the mother, and then there's the relatives that have passed away in the past. The great humor, and then someone asks, "Well, you haven't described the women folk yet."
Yep,
right, they're taking care of the kids next house over, and then in come several women with a gaggle of kids running around, and we're you know, the two of us are detailing all of this stuff. And the players, and then they're like, "Well, you got to stay overnight in our furnished attic, which secretly is entirely infested with the horrible cursed mold." And the players successfully like, "Nope, we're all claustrophobic." we're not going to do, and that was exactly the thing that they had to avoid doing. It seemed enjoyable for everybody for those kinds of scenes.
I think I'm trying to get us on the topic of like, what is it like to co-DM social encounters, and like, I think it was important in those cases, right, that I was trying to, those were the points where I was trying to cede control to you, because I'm like, I want you to like push the agenda of the NPCs. But it was also really nice for me to have a voice present.
Totally.
Right? A as narrator, right? So I could say things like, oh, here comes the women and children from next door coming over for the big midday meal, right, that everyone was having together. And then also to be able to furnish in little details, right? I would add this secondary character who could just chuck in some random little bits of information if I wanted to try and give the players more clues as to what was going on.
Yeah.
Right. So we did a little bit of that, right? There was
totally. Yeah. Totally. And that was key for both of us, I think. Both of us stepping in and going, having a voice to go, here's the piece of information that maybe we're overlooking or add some nuance to it. Likewise, when you get to the castle of the Pumpkin King and I start, you know, running, I start portraying the slightly crazed, bombastic Pumpkin King on his throne. Yeah. And there's the point where, you know, you just all of a sudden conjure a vizier character and lean in and go, my liege, don't forget about blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I'm so, that was just the perfect moment. I needed that reminder right there, or whatever it was. I needed, and specifically, and you said like, he's whispering, but he's whispering so loud that the characters can still hear him. So this is information for the players that was.
Yeah.
Now my question, Paul, that comes to mind is that, again, with this particular adventure that's at a high scope, none of what we're talking about is in the text.
That is right. And that's something I enjoy as a DM, right? I will say that as a DM, I like content like this where the descriptions are very short and I'm required during play to fill in the gaps and adjust as we go. And it's actually one of the questions I came away with is, should we edit the text to put that vizier character in?
This is what I'm asking.
Right.
Yeah.
So okay. So let's break it down. Let's talk about a little bit more about this specific.
And let me say, so these are things that we discovered in play.
Yeah.
Right. It felt right. It even felt important. So do we go back and do we add these explicitly in the text?
So if you're following along, if you have the PDF, you don't have the PDF. We haven't published it yet.
Correct.
If you remember and saw the episode where we did this 2 years ago, that's not. Okay, where to go from here? So on the map, let's show the map. How about that? So on the map, this is I think area two is a castle, and inside the castle is the Pumpkin King, and I think what's detailed there is him and he's a wizard. He's level 6. He's got a magic staff.
We just added that. He just became a wizard 2 days ago, to be clear. He wasn't the case until 48 hours ago.
But what I'm trying to talk about, like, what's on the page now and whether or not we need to edit
So
he's there. He's on a magic throne. Mm-hmm. He's got a staff that's got magical powers, right? And it details his 8 guards that are pretty tough, very tough guards that he's got.
Yep.
But then on the social side, it mentions...
And what he wants the players to do.
Right.
He wants players to take seeds, spread the seeds.
Right, that's right. He's got pumpkin seeds that he wants the players to take around and spread about, right?
Yep.
So, but more specifically, then there's the context of the Pumpkin King itself and the history behind the Pumpkin King, which is that basically this land is stuck in this forever fall harvest time cycle, mm-hmm. right? It never changes. It's always fall here. There's always a harvest feast. Like, one of the funny things is the players show up and like, oh, what a happy accident. You arrived on our feast day. And great, that is an unusual coincidence. Well, maybe, I mean, we have them every day, so maybe not. which I adore. But you did come on a very special day because it is when we were holding these competitions, which we only do annually. And as it turns out, the reason they hold these competitions annually is to elect who is going to be the new Pumpkin King. And part of the process of doing that is they must consume the old prior
mm-hmm.
king,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's really kind of weird and nefarious. Right, and it's a little bit of a secret. I think the text implies that it's a secret, right? That the Pumpkin King. I don't know if it implies that. Did we make that up? Did we make that up, or is that in the text that it's a secret?
I want to say it's in that part's in the text.
That's part.
But
in
I'm
the
not
text.
Sure
okay.
now.
Right. So the gist is right. Well, the way we had planned it prior to going in was that when the players come in, you know, there's plenty of servants and other people, and in addition to the Pumpkin King and his guard in this castle, right? And it's this big festive thing. And they're encouraged to come in and join in on the feast, and we're going to play these games, right? Where we're going to, like, we decide there'll be a test of strength. Who's the strongest character? Like, who can lift the most pumpkins? There's going to be a contest of mirth, which is basically a joke-telling competition. Tell us your best joke. And then the final round would be a pie-eating contest, which humorously will be the pie containing the Pumpkin King, right? So whoever eats the most is going to become the new Pumpkin King.
And to be clear, so I was playing it that for the prior feasting, the king was eating too much. And so right prior to the last beat, He's like, I'm afraid that I must retire, but the vizier will take care of the last ceremony. Yeah. So he stepped off stage in order to be cooked.
Okay, so here's where it got really interesting. I think one of the real advantages of having two DMs came up at this point, right? So I'm just gonna mention here, Kevin Thompson asked, I can't put this on screen. You can put his question on screen or not. But he asked, how many players did we have? The answer is we have six. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Six players playing it. And at this point, we have one halfling character who's made it a bit of a joke about himself overeating, right?
Yes.
He's playing into the overeating side, and we've played into that a little bit. So that's funny, right? And we're like, okay, he's clearly going to eat some of this pie. And then we had two other players who won the other two competitions, right? We have one player who was the strongest in the feats of strength and one player who told the best joke, right? So we're going to put these three people at the table to eat pie, right? As that's happening, right? And then I kind of gave a little bit of a lull to the party at that point intentionally to give the players a chance to interact and like push their own agendas. And so some of them, they kind of split up and start mingling and are talking. Some of them are just talking to different people at the feast, which is great because that gave us a chance to give some more information that is a little weird and unusual. Like, I had one of the NPCs talking about the lineage of the Pumpkin King, and like, gosh, there sure have been a lot of kings, right?
Right.
Right. And they all remember all these kings,
right?
Because there's one a year. So, yeah.
We avoided saying that, but we clearly clued them into there's been too many kings.
Yep. And the players are trying to angle for, they want an entourage of guards to go with them up into the mountains because they've heard there's monsters up there and they want help clearing out the monsters to get across the pass. And weirdly, they ask something like, well, will the king send an entourage to help us? And we kind of weirdly worded the answer of like, well, if you do well in the competitions, then surely you'll be in a position to command a large group of the king's guards, right? By becoming the next Pumpkin King. But, you know.
the other thing that the players picked up on, and it was one of these happy accidents, is I was having the king speak, and at some point he said, yes, we keep the plants close to our hearts.
Yeah.
Like, we seek bounty, we seek to nourish the land, and we seek to keep the plants close to our hearts. And one of the players is like, I don't like the sound of that at all.
Yeah. So the players are definitely on edge here. They know something is unusual and weird about all this. So at this point, the players are having conversations, and because you're the adversary, you're voicing some of the NPCs. So I think some of them were talking to you. I kind of lost track of what was going on your side at this point, because I had one player tell me, well, I'm gonna slip on my elven cloak, and I'm going to sneak around. And I was like, okay, great. Right?
Notably into the kitchen.
Yeah. And specifically, he says, I want to go find the kitchen. I'm like, okay, great. So I take him aside. I take him away from the table. And now I'm adjudicating what's going on with him to give him information, and I've totally lost track of what's happening at the main table.
Yeah, this is, you know what, this is, I mean, we've never talked about this, but this is a slight little additional advantage to co-DMing, is that you can do the sidebar, and I can still be having stuff happen at the main table in parallel.
That's really nice, nice. So he sneaks into the kitchen, and, you know, long story short is that he witnesses them dicing up the Pumpkin King to make this giant pumpkin pie that they're going to serve for the pie-eating contest. And he's, of course, horrified, right? So he immediately retreats from the kitchen to go back and find his friends. And as I return to the table, I have a second PC who's then saying, I also have a sub of agenda. I want to tell the guards that I want to go and see to our mule. I want to go to the stables and see to our mule. And the guards don't really want to leave people unattended, so I have a guard escort him. And so now this player and I walk into the kitchen, you know, away from the gaming table to have a little sidebar. And he goes out there and he tries to like subtly get rid of the guard if he possibly can, and it's not working. I'm having my guard be like, nope, I'm a guard, I'm gonna guard you, right? And so ultimately he just casts Charm Person on the guard. And I'm like, okay, this is it, right? Now you've got him charmed, now you're definitely gonna get whatever information you want. He's gonna start asking me great questions. No, instead he says, because he's the person I think who won the strength competition,
he won the strength competition.
Yeah. And he specifically says, I want you to go back in there and ask to be my stand-in in the pie-eating contest. And of course, as a DM, I'm like, well, they won't like that, right? B, like, it's probably completely unheard of, right? The point is that the point was that you were a champion of one of the previous contests. You're eligible to now be the Pumpkin King, right? see, like, they want to take over the PCs, not Arbitrary Guard, right? Mm-hmm. So yep. Everything about this is bad. But he's charmed. So he's saying things like, well, it's never been done before, and I think that they won't like it. And the player gives me a line that says, well, I'm allergic to pumpkins. and I'm just like, I'm pretty sure that all the NPCs in this game are going to be absolutely horrified by that, right? So, but I'm like, okay, I'm charmed. I'm going to do exactly what you say. So I walk back into the room. And I missed some context here, which is specifically that up to this point, you had been role-playing the Pumpkin King himself.
Right. Who's now gone.
Right.
Who's now been, you know, retired.
And then I made up this secondary character, which I originally called, I don't know if you missed this, but I originally called him just a Seneschal. And you turned him into a vizier.
Yes. Okay.
Like, okay, fine, he's a vizier. Right. But he's this you know, servant to the king who's advising the king or whatnot. Well, the king has left, right, to go be diced up to be in the pie. I'm not sure at this point who you were role-playing at the table.
This is a good question, because you were out of the room. So I was role-playing various, like, lower-level, like, you know, attendees of the feast or guards or things like that is what I was doing. So they were chatting for more information, and I was kind of giving them garbled information from low-level servants is what I was doing.
Awesome. So I come back into the room, and I'm role-playing the charmed guard who's going to propose that he sit in for the other player in the pie-eating contest. And I'm like, well, who's he going to address? Obviously the vizier. So I sit down next to Dan, and I say, Dan, you have to play the vizier now. which is hilarious, right? It's the first time we've been in this situation where we've invented this NPC, and now I'm going to hand him off to you. You role-play as the vizier, please.
Right.
And Dan's like, okay. And then I start delivering these really, because of course I'm thinking of myself as like, okay, I'm role-playing a charmed character who's doing something that is a little contrary to what he thinks is socially acceptable.
Yep.
So he comes in and he says, I insist that I be allowed to stand in for this other person in the pumpkin eating contest. And Dan naturally is role-playing, you know, like you want to say no, like ultimately you want to say no, what I would want to do as
there
Dan
you go.
As well.
Yeah.
So you're saying like, no, that's unheard of. And I'm like, yep, I understand that. It's never been done before. I agree. Yet I insist that it happen.
Because there was this tense look between us of like I'm not sure what you want right now, but I'm going to go with what I think the vizier would say. And then there's this look of relief on your face of like, yes, I understand. I'm like, good. I'm good. That was where he thought this was going.
So I'm role-playing this guy, right? I insist that you do this, blah, blah, blah. And so then I give the line, and this is a nice point where I got to play referee a little bit, where I said, like, oh, and I mean, he cannot compete because he's allergic to pumpkins. And then I say, and of course, the entire assembly of people gasps at that, right?
Another option I could have taken at that point would be like, this is an outrage, arrest him immediately.
Right, that would have been great.
I don't know if he wanted that.
That would have been great, okay. I would have loved that.
All right. I didn't know how intense I was supposed to go at that point.
That would have been fine. Right. Yeah, maybe in retrospect, maybe I should have very quickly sidebarred with you just to say like, look, I'm going to
You know what?
Stuff.
I No.
No?
You know
no,
what?
You like the
no,
surprise?
I actually really like the no net. It felt hard. There was a moment of like roller coaster horror. But no, I actually really like the no net. Let's talk about that a little bit. So we wind up doing like the game is half improv, right? The game winds up being like half improv stage show, which is not our intent, but that's what winds up happening anyway. And so among the things that are, you know, important in that situation are, you know, among the rules of like improv classes and stuff like that is really listening to your partner, really listening to your scene partner. In particular, when they come up, or a lot of the time in improv, it's recommended that person A give the details about person B to them. Mm-hmm. Which as a D&D player seems like an outrage the first time I heard about that, right? But in improv, it's considered, you know, a gift. They call it a gift of like you're getting more information that you didn't have to work for.
Yep.
And so it's really important that you listen, particularly when, you know, details or when names come up. You've got to listen to the names when they come up so that you can continue to consistently refer to them that way. And you and I had brief, I think we do well. I think we had brief moments where. So tell me about the Marvin name.
When the two farmers were introduced,
right.
I think I swear in the beginning you introduced both of us by name, but then continually addressed me as Marvin. right? So, and then at some point it came up like a question of like, what is the character that I'm playing? What's his name? And I was like, I remember there being two names, and I've heard the name Marvin an awful lot, but I'm pretty sure that if I've heard the name a lot, it's because I'm being addressed, therefore that's my name. I don't know what your name is.
Yeah, we had this eye connection of like has my character been named and what? Yeah. Like, I don't think so. And so I was like, well, I'm Edwin.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
So over time, particularly where, you know, I think that, and this is a separate issue, I think that initially it was supposed to be one single farmhouse with maybe five farmers, but now it's an entire community of 20 people, and we're coming out with more and more people and more relations. And you really have to dig into your head that the names are actually fairly important. And then the brand new thing that we've never done is this idea of switching a character. And so when you handed me the Vizier, I'm like, yep, of course I'm going to play the Vizier. And the moment is like, I really wish that I'd been paying attention to what voice Paul had been using. Right? I regret not really hearing the voice and the character it was subtle, whatever it was. It wasn't a super broad voice anyway.
It wasn't.
But I think that I came away saying that now that the threat is on the table that you might swap characters midstream, that I have all the time, I have to pay attention to the voice and the gestures of every character that you do, just in case I have to sit in that seat. Now, postscript to that. We came home and you introduced me to the improv Netflix specials by Middle Ditch and Schwartz, right?
Yep.
And
it's called just that, Middle Ditch and Schwartz. You can look it up. Great improv.
I had not seen them doing improv before. I've seen them in other TV shows. What I had been introduced to for long-form improv are the TG and Dave guys from Chicago that were in Sonic ads a while back, more or less similar structure. But I couldn't believe it, but we start watching it, and they had exactly those issues happen on stage in this that I've never seen before. It's one, bobbling a little bit names, right? Having a bunch of characters come up, and then in some cases bobbling and then somewhat, you know, amusingly breaking the fourth wall of like, I don't remember the name of the character that I'm playing right now. Or at a point like, I need more details about this character. Please tell me more about this character because it's getting too heavy for me right now. Right. Yeah. And the bit about, and they routinely do this of have a character that both players swap into back and forth.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd ever seen that before. And it was crazy that we had just done that for the first time ever hours beforehand.
Yeah. I thought one of the most interesting things about that was they have a scene where they're doing a whole wedding scene, right? And what they do is that they play with the physical space of where the character is standing a lot, right?
Right.
So, and I didn't realize this was happening at first, but you have the scene where, like, you have the two couples who are, the couple who's getting married, right? And they're just standing facing each other, so their sides to the audience, and then one of them goes to play the officiant and stands with his back to the audience.
Yeah,
and I'm like, that's a bold move in theater to stand with your back to the audience and address. But I realized it was very important because that became the physical position. So you knew when someone stood there with their back to the audience, you knew they were playing the officiant, right? And then they're also jumping around. They have some chairs and they're jumping around to like, now I'm an audience. Now I'm a member of the guest. I'm a guest. I'm this specific guest, and they're playing with that of like, if I'm sitting right here, then I must be this guest, and if I'm sitting right there, I must be that guest.
Yeah, it made sense because the officiator has got to be facing the audience, right? It wouldn't make any sense. It has got to be facing the guests of the wedding.
Yeah, yeah.
So it wouldn't make any sense for them to be out at the, you know, pointed at the audience away from the guests. So you just had to commit to that. Yeah. But I agree. That was a bold choice. You have to be completely square back to the audience.
Yeah, which is odd
at that moment. And that's it's funny because, you know, the best thing in those moments is to go with the most dangerous. If there's an obvious dangerous thing, like you've got to do that.
Now, I don't know that particularly applies to co-DMing a game, but certainly I think it's interesting to consider that we might have to swap characters. And therefore, you have to listen to your co-DM and like listen for the cues of what kind of cues can I give that I am now this character. So it's less jarring to the players that they know that they're still interacting with the same character, even though is being played by a different DM right now,
great,
which is very interesting. Right?
On that point, William was asking when we were doing the farmhands, did I dig into my New England farmer accent? And the answer is absolutely yes. That was like the key thing. And I think it makes an impact. I've done that in improv classes in the past, and it came off very well. I will say that it had a good reaction, particularly when I have someone else to play off of. And I think that over a couple minutes, the accent gets somewhat more intense, right? And yep. So I've had an improv class where I very quickly fell into old New Englander running a shop and his wife, who's also run the shop for a long time. Oh, mother, you better get in here because there's a bunch of crazy people that are looking for something. I don't get remember what we had. So I guess I've learned that's in my toolbox. Nice. So yes, nice. I definitely knew going to the farmhands that I was going to.
Now, as I think about that, if we were going to do this again, I would start to think about things. One of the nice things in D&D is it's very easy for me to just say, "Dan, you're the vizier now," right? I can say that as DM narrator or whatnot, like, which is maybe not something you want to say in an improv show. You're now this character, go, right? Like, I think that was one of the funny things about Middle Ditch and Schwartz is them trying to guess at each other, like, which character do you think you're playing right now, right?
Yes, you're right.
Which is very interesting.
Right. But even there, I mean, and that's something that is, I think, a little different with TJ and Dave, is that their Middle Ditch and Schwartz are willing, if they need to say it out loud.
Yep. Occasionally, they want to break the fourth wall.
If they really get off rails, they actually will say, "Who am I playing right now?"
Yeah.
It's nice. It's nice that they give themselves the flexibility if that's what it takes to get back on track. They can do that, and you can do that in a D&D game. That's okay.
Well, now the other things I might do in a D&D game that we're not doing, right, is I might introduce some props, right? Maybe we have a hat for the Pumpkin King. And then we can have some kind of physical element. So I can just put this hat on and now I'm the Pumpkin King, right? You wear it, now you're the Pumpkin King, right?
And it might be a nice replacement because if you are doing improv stage stuff, you have the whole stage to position yourself with, right? And they have chairs, they can move around the chairs.
You're stuck at a table.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You have much more restricted space probably. Yeah. And so maybe having some props to do that lifting would be nice.
So let me get back to the question we're trying to pose because there's not much time left. Should we write the vizier character in? Or was that just good DMing in the moment of, like, that's what that scene needed for that group at that time, and in a different run, somebody will do something totally different?
I think my initial knee-jerk reaction is that it's intrinsic to this large-scale wilderness adventure that you're gonna have a paragraph of description for a whole castle.
Yeah.
And I think that if we started injecting stuff like the vizier and other stuff like that, I feel like this adventure could easily blossom from 2 pages to at least 50 pages.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right? And I don't think that's our intent. I think we want to give, an old school flavored adventure to DMs that have that kind of flexibility.
Yeah.
And we're doing things specific for co-DMs. We're having two voices at a time is nice.
Yep.
That might not be the best thing for every DM.
It's a good point. If I was running this solo, I might just have the king himself dictate all the rules to all of the, all the games and whatnot, right? Yep. And probably don't even need a vizier character at that. Now, what I will say is what's interesting from the text, that the important part from the text is that when it comes to a combat encounter, that there are 8 very difficult guards, and there is a boss who is a powerful wizard, right? And that's what you want. And it would make sense to me that normally in playing this, like, if the players turn it into a fight fairly early on, it would totally make sense that that wizard boss is the king.
Yeah.
Whereas, when the king exits to get chopped up to be put in the pie, that maybe having somebody else be the powerful wizard is actually now more interesting.
And that was a call that you made on the fly.
That was the call, yesterday. Well, and when it got into a combat, the vizier was there, and the players were clearly like, the players believed he was in charge. Right? The players were like, the vizier is bad news, he's got to be killed.
Right.
And I'm looking at the 2 paragraphs of text we have for this entry, and I'm like, well, there's a stat block for a wizard. It's supposed to be the Pumpkin King, but it's the vizier now.
Yeah.
Right. And that actually worked very well.
Yeah, it did. And to be clear, when the ultimate pie came out, enough creepy stuff had been happening, and enough players had been at least 2 or 3 players had deduced that they were going to consume the king. Most everybody stepped away from the pie, and then one of the players jumped and backstabbed the vizier in the back.
Yep.
And sprayed his
sprayed his blood all over the pie, which was great because we still had one player who was eager to eat the pie, and he was like leaning in, about to eat, and then boom,
you know,
sword in the back and blood everywhere. Yeah, it was a very nice moment, very pleasant. I really enjoyed
is,
that.
Paul, is it the case that D&D games always turn to horror games, or was this just a Halloween flavored game that we'd?
I mean, I will admit, the first time I ran this game, I ran it using the mental stress cards from Fearful Ends to even push it further into the realm of horror. So definitely this adventure, I think, has a horror tone to it.
Yeah.
Whether or not every D&D game becomes horror or not.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I know you argue that it does. I don't think that's necessarily true, but maybe let's say that you and I enjoy it when it does. So possibly our games are more prone to go in that direction because we like it.
Maybe so. Yeah. Maybe so. But or maybe, you know, that's just really the root of D&D, right? Yeah. That's where it comes from.
It's fair. It's fair. And we are out of time.
That just flew by, Paul. That just flew by like absolutely nothing.
Do you have any final thoughts or comments on co-DMing or on the Creeping Doom of the Pumpkin King in specific?
I think that this was a really good learning experience for me about, to kind of highlight the difference, dungeon wilderness. Mm-hmm. It's a larger scale. There's more opportunity to fill things. I mean, for what it's worth, I hear about, you know, Classic Traveler, where every world was randomized and fly. A whole planet would be like a single result on a random table and stuff like that. So you can run games at a highly improvisational level. It is successful. I think it would be maybe a misstep to go ahead and try to detail all of these things in a large scale adventure. I think that, you know, DMs would get bogged down. It wouldn't all be appropriate for every session or every play group. So I think it's a good opportunity to embrace the improvisation, whether you've got co-DMs or whether it's one DM and a bunch of players, is a really good opportunity for that. I would say, like, if you're a starting DM, I think that this highlights for me that the structure of a dungeon adventure is a really good starting point to constrain the options, to constrain the space that you have to detail or give choices for. And I do think that running large-scale wilderness adventures is a slightly more advanced thing, and you probably want to, you know, use the structure of a dungeon the first time you ever make an adventure.
That's an interesting point. I would say, like, the way we ran this is very reminiscent to me of the way I prefer to run my D&D campaigns, and it's interesting to me to look at BX. I'm going to harp on BX again a little bit and say, like, maybe they did it really quite right there in choosing to have the basic game focus on dungeons up to third level, and then fourth level you flip over into the expert set, and now you're introducing wilderness. Because that is the way I like to run my campaigns, is that there's a big overland map, a big wilderness map, and then I take little dungeons I like. I tend to avoid the giant mega dungeons. I want a smaller, more concise dungeon, and I sprinkle them around and chuck them in there.
Yeah.
Even if they're, like, and that's exactly how I ran my last long-running classic D&D campaign, is I started with Bone Hill, which gives a great kind of sandbox, overland, wilderness area, and then I just started taking little adventures I liked and popping them in place and saying, like, here's a pre-written dungeon module I really love. It's here on the map.
You've called that quilting in the past,
I think
about that every time I stay quilting over, because frankly, you give me a quilt. I when I'm here, I sleep under a quilt made up of old D&D t-shirts, actually. Yeah. So, and frankly, every time I snuggle in to go to sleep here, I think about your quilting technique running campaigns.
Yeah.
It sounds like it works very well.
I really like it. That's the way I love to run.
And the other thing I would say is that this, it's an interesting opportunity to once again reflect on improvisational techniques.
Yeah.
And it was really, really almost creepy how many things came up for the first time in this game that then you showed me in these improv specials on Netflix was so paralyzing.
I think
really
improv
uncanny.
Is an incredible skill for DMs to have. And like you should go out and get the book Improv for Gamers.
Yep, by Karen Twelves.
Karen Twelves. That's a great book. Highly recommend it. Great skill to have.
And the other thing is that the very first episode of this Middleditch and Schwartz that we watched, They step on stage, and the first two characters that get named are Dan and Paul.
That's true. I totally forgot about that.
That's like right out of an A24 film. That's completely creepy. What the hell?
One final note I'll add before we wrap up is I'm hopeful that this experience is going to unlock us for future dungeon design dashes. It's a bit of content I love doing on this show, yeah. So I'm eager to not only to do it again, but to like iron out the wrinkles in the process so we don't get gummed up again like we did.
I agree.
Yeah.
Well put.
Yeah. Great. Viewers, if you have any thoughts on like what part of that process you'd like to see us stream about, like do you want to see us do an edit pass? Do you want to see us do a live play of a play test? Leave us a comment in the YouTube comments here. We'd love to hear from you, and it will absolutely direct future episodes of the show.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. And don't forget that we're on a ton of social media as the Wandering DMs. We're on Facebook and Twitter and Twitch and GitHub and a bunch of other sites. We do have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please look for us there and make a hash out of that like button. Subscribe! Thank you!
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those files on our website at wanderingdms.com. You can also find us on various podcast carriers like iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to us on one of those sites right now, and the site offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
You know, we really do. And, of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here every week at Wandering DMs. We could not do what we do here for our setup without their help. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And among the benefits of every tier, just like Paul said at the top of the show, you'll get access to a private Discord server where the conversations are happening 24/7 with our just the best patrons, just the best, most intelligent, wise viewers about D&D and running games as DMs and horror games and miniatures and all kinds of stuff like that. So we would love to see you join us in about 10 minutes for the live video after chat to continue the conversation and what you've done about social interactions in your games or wilderness games or interactions with improvisational NPCs or all kinds of stuff like that. So we'll hope to see you there in a couple minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. So don't forget, we're here every Sunday we can possibly make it. So we expect to be here again Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.